What's up? I'm Blaine Lane. You're listening to Two People. It's a podcast about Richmond. Each episode on the show, we talk to someone about who they are and what they do. Now, normally we talk to Richmonders, but today's episode is an exception. We're bringing someone in from the outside, and we're hoping to get some perspective on how we might think about our own town. On today's show, I sit down with Josh Yates. Josh is the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture over at the University of Virginia. And if you're the type of person that likes thinking about cities, you know, how does it work? How do we understand it? Then this is the episode for you. Josh is running a project aimed at understanding the factors that make a city thrive. The project is called Thriving Cities, and Richmond is one of the pilot cities they're studying. Yeah, cool, right? We talk about how a city is less like a factory and more like a complex living ecosystem. I asked Josh for his thoughts on mid-sized cities. We also talk about the role of millennials or young professionals to a city. And Josh underlines why this idea of building unusual coalitions is so important to building a healthy urban region. Josh is a super smart dude. He's really personable and fun. You get to hear about some stories when he was younger. This is episode 19 with Josh Yates. You're listening to Two People. Josh Yates, you are here. Thanks for being on the show, man.
My pleasure.
We are glad you're here. So you are the director for the Institute of Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. What all does IASC do?
Yeah, it's a research institute that brings together people in the humanities and the social sciences to tackle the big questions of the human condition in our time.
That's big thinking.
It is big thinking.
We've brought you here today to talk about thriving cities. Can you briefly describe the Thriving Cities Project in your role?
Sure. Yeah, Thriving Cities Project is an initiative of the Institute. Got launched about 4 years ago or so. The overall objective is to answer the question, what does it mean and take to thrive in today's world? And we have a special focus clearly on cities, which I can say more about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Richmond is one of them.
And Richmond is one of our pilot cities. Yeah. Oh, man.
We're going to get into that. So I want to go backwards.
Sure.
To really understand, how did Josh Yates get to where you are now? You grew up in Big Sky Country, right?
That's
Montana.
Right.
Montana. What was it like growing up in Montana?
As you know, picture paradise.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much that.
And you go back?
Yeah. Yeah. Every summer we go back, my wife and kids. We go back in usually the month of July, which is a sublime time to be there.
What did you do for fun growing up in Montana?
I grew up on a fairly big glacial lake called Flathead Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of the time in my free time on that lake in one form or another.
Summer and winter?
Summer and winter, yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, taking advantage of the great outdoors, hiking and fishing and mm-hmm. all those sorts of things. Yeah.
How'd you get to the East Coast?
Following college, I did the one thing that no right-thinking Montanan ever does, mm-hmm. and I moved to Washington, D.C.
Ah.
Right?
That's a rude awakening.
It is a rude awakening, yeah. And so I came out to work in a fellowship program in D.C. that was working on hunger and homelessness issues.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up out here.
And you went to undergrad in Montana?
Yeah, at the University of Montana.
What'd you study undergrad?
My undergrad was kind of history and philosophy okay. joint major, yeah.
Because I'm interested in sort of the chapters of your intellectual growth.
Yeah.
Because it seems like a lot of the work you do now is around cities, certainly, but also like what does it mean to thrive? What does living like a good full life look like?
Yes.
Both individually, but I think also as a region or as a people socially, et cetera. Was that something you were interested in from a young age, like when you were middle school, high school?
Yeah, it's a good question. Probably not in so many words or, yeah, quite.
You wouldn't have said that then.
I certainly wouldn't have said that. Yeah, I think I've always had an interest in what makes groups of people and society kind of tick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a particular interest in over the years in how it is as we as a people engage the kind of wicked problems, right?
Yeah.
That's always sort of preoccupied me, had an interest in that. And therefore, the flip side of the coin What is flourishing?
Hmm.
What does that mean? And so those have sort of been, I think, ideas that have sort of been there latently in my intellectual journey that over time have become more, have crystallized in certain
right.
ways. And I would say over the past 10 years or so, most of my intellectual life and research has been dedicated to thinking about those things.
Were there any experiences that shaped you early, whether it was the work in DC or were you a VISTA volunteer at one point?
I was.
Is that through AmeriCorps?
Yeah. So okay. I think if I understand it correct, so I came out from Montana to DC
mm-hmm.
to be in a fellowship program called the Mickey Leland Hunger Fellowship.
Okay.
And my understanding is that was the first year of AmeriCorps and they combined VISTA and AmeriCorps together in that fellowship.
Oh, wow.
And so I spent, as part of my fellowship year, half of my year doing field work up in Binghamton, New York, where I was working on for a program that was, this is in the very early days of what I think is called food recovery programs or rescue programs.
Huh.
So I drove a big refrigerated truck around the community and picked up food from groceries, food that they weren't going to
yeah,
sell
yeah.
from grocery stores and brought it to soup kitchens.
That's like, it's almost like the reverse ice cream man.
Yeah,
rather than driving around giving food out, you're taking it in and taking it to where it needs to go.
Exactly, exactly. So I helped get something called Broom Bounty off the ground
okay.
there. And then the other part of the fellowship was to connect field work with policy work. So then I went back to Washington and I worked at the USDA on... sort of related issues, but from a different perspective, because the idea was that practitioners and people in the policy world rarely, talk to each
mm.
other. So this was a way of training people, to think, to have the experience, in both worlds.
Were you out doing the field work first and then policy, or were you
yeah.
doing,
okay. Yeah. They were sort of one and then the other kind of.
That's so interesting. Cause on some level you have to be a practitioner to be out and about to understand the nature of the problems so that you can actually discern from a policy perspective, how can you actually go about taking the first step and solving
that's
this?
Right.
You can't be, on the, 18th floor on high. You have to be in.
Well, you can, but oftentimes that leads to disaster.
Right. That's not the best way.
That's not the best way.
It can be done.
It is done often,
right.
unfortunately, yeah.
So I want to jump forward
sure.
to talk a little bit about thriving cities.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Thriving Cities Project come to be?
Yeah, I suppose the quickest answer to that is that, as I mentioned, I've had this preoccupation with questions of what does it mean? How do we think about flourishing? How do we think about thriving? And I had a longstanding interest in the kind of changes that are taking place today. And so one of the things that began to become clear to me, and this is not news now, the human races today, we've crossed a really significant threshold in that we are predominantly an urban species.
Hmm.
And that may not sound like all that much of a news story or newsflash, but it turns out that for the most of the history of the human race, we've been a predominantly rural species. And in about 2010-ish, I suppose, statistically, we've crossed that
right.
threshold.
Right.
And all of the demographic trends...
More people live in cities now
than in the country or
right.
some other form. And so all the trends only suggest that that's going to grow exponentially
right.
in coming years. And so that means that anybody concerned with the question of what does it mean to take to thrive or flourish is going to have to understand that that's going to be a predominantly urban question.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Thriving City Project emerges... in part out of that recognition and concern.
Hmm. So, in a way, I don't think this is a stretch, but you have migrated to the city yourself, coming from Montana.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You're probably not the trendsetter, but there are other things happening.
There are other things, yeah.
When you talk about thriving,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a word that you hear often. What does thriving actually mean when you use it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And in fact, too often it's used kind of too easily as a synonym for other kinds of words. So you'll hear people say something like, they'll talk about prosperity or livability or maybe sustainability. There's a bunch of these words that we kind of traffic in that are usually used as synonyms.
Mm-hmm.
And actually thriving for us is distinctive and it's doing some work. So this is a place where semantics really does matter. So what do we mean by thriving? Well, the first thing to understand about thriving is that it is not a state like you achieve a state of thriving.
You can't say we have arrived. We're on the thriving platform.
Yeah. And here we're good, right? Thriving is a sort of, you can think of it as an activity. So it's like growth, growing,
right?
The original sense of thriving was a sense of maturation or growth, right? Or prospering in that sense of growing and growing into the fullness of one's potential.
Right.
So it's an activity. And really it's kind of a set of practices that we're trying to cultivate that in ourselves and in our communities.
Yeah.
It's also deeply relational. It can't just happen on its own. People don't thrive on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's not an individual thing. It involves the individual, but it importantly involves the wider community in which the individual is embedded.
Yeah. I think, to say it back to you, thriving is not static, but it's dynamic.
It's absolutely
moving. It's happening. It's fluid. And it's also not linear, but it's a web of interconnected individuals, relationships, institutions.
Right.
One thing that you talk about is this concept of human ecology. And I think in a lot of ways, that concept is a different model for thinking about cities than most. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of human ecology?
Sure.
Maybe we've already answered the question.
No, we haven't. We haven't. And if it's okay, I'll give you a little parable.
Yes.
I call it the parable of the wolf.
Okay.
So I'm actually going to go away from cities for a second and go back to Montana.
Yeah, yeah. Join us on the journey.
Join us on the journey.
We are now back in Montana.
That's right. I feel like we should be doing the Wayne's World.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
All right. So so what some people may know is that about 75 years ago or so, people in the Yellowstone area hunted the wolf population to extinction. Okay. And at the time it was billed as a great success, right? These were a menace, right? Among other things, because they killed the cattle of the ranchers that lived alongside the park. And it would be like if we got rid of the mosquito today, right? Mm-hmm. People were pretty excited about that.
Right.
So now fast forward about 75 years. So what began to happen in the park is that all of the various wildlife biologists and scientists who study the park and its health began to notice that in different parts of the park, whatever they were studying was kind of out of whack. And it all began to coalesce around the disappearance of these aspen groves.
Hmm.
So there used to be these plentiful, beautiful aspen groves that would kind of dot the landscape of Yellowstone or different parts of Yellowstone. And they began to disappear.
These are just groves of trees.
Groves of trees. Right. Yeah, yeah. Beautiful aspen trees. And then, you know, then other scientists began to see that, you know, the aquatic, you know, the fish, the trout and so forth that were in the streams were beginning to have trouble and on it went. And so they of course started talking to each other, comparing notes, and lo and behold, what they saw were a series of interconnections, right? What they call cascading effects. And so what they realized is when the wolves got hunted to extinction, the elk and deer populations exploded, right? And it turns out that elk love the taste of aspen bark.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? They went on an eating rampage around the park and started devouring the aspen bark and killing the trees faster than they could reproduce.
Wow.
But the interesting thing about this is that they then discovered that not only was this having an impact on the aspen, you know, like a set of interlinking connections, it was having, you know, downstream having all kinds of impact on other animals, various kinds of, you know, flora and fauna. And then eventually even the geography of Yellowstone itself began to change. And so what the wildlife biologists call these kinds of species that have a disproportionate impact on the health and well-being of the other species in the ecosystem, they call those keystone species.
Right.
And so that becomes that way of thinking about a set of interconnections, a web of interconnections, as you said, becomes the way that we look at a human community. As an ecosystem, as an ecology, we call it a human ecology. And what we're interested in are understanding the nature of those interconnections, right? And whether or not they're healthy and to what degree there might be certain kinds of problems happening, right that we can identify. Yeah. And ultimately, we're interested in identifying those kind of keystone variables that play that similar role.
Yeah, because I think that there is, it's easy to think, using sort of the model of a city as an ecosystem, to think we could remove one thing or turn this little lever and think it's great. But if we're not thinking long range and we're not understanding the web of interconnections in a region or a city, there may be some unintended consequences down the line.
Absolutely.
Where the aspen trees are gone.
Well, think of urban renewal, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the 50s and 60s, where we had a problem we were trying to solve, and we thought about it in a very linear, as you said, way, or a very kind of siloed mm-hmm. way. And we thought we were doing a good thing by creating kind of public housing and so forth. But it turned out that the legacy of that in our cities has been an utter nightmare.
Right.
Because we didn't think through what the ramifications and the sets of interconnections have been.
It takes a different way of thinking, obviously. Like, you have to think of more of a network. But I think you don't always know what the unintended consequences will be.
No.
Right? Like, you could do something that you think is good, but it may be that down the road you actually made the wrong decision, but you don't always know. And so I think I admire the work that you guys are doing, because it's trying to give clarity to, you actually can understand these things on some level. It's not airtight. This isn't a science, but there are some indicators and there are some things we can look at to really try to understand.
Yeah, it's both a science and an art. It tries to say that there are some cautionary tales, that there are no silver bullets. Like, right. We're just going to do this one right. thing and it's going to solve all our problems. But it does counsel that in order to tackle the problems that we're interested in, housing, poverty, mm-hmm. transportation, whatever, that we're best off, the wisest course of action is going to be understanding how those are connected to other things and therefore how we have to work together with others.
I want to ask about the six endowments.
Mm-hmm.
What are they and how do they work?
Sure. So if you think about a community in terms of this web of interconnection,
mm-hmm.
all right, that's great at some sort of conceptual level. The question is, how do we begin to get a grip on that? Right.
Right.
How do we make that a little bit more concrete? And so the endowments are at least one step in that direction, and we can go further down mm-hmm. from there. But what these endowments are the sort of six dimensions of that web of interconnection that we think ultimately create the building blocks of thriving in any community. What are those? What are the fundamental kinds of connections that we
yeah.
find? What are the activities
right.
that humans do all the time
right.
that produce a certain kind of value?
Right.
Right. That we think are all necessary for having thriving.
Right. And if it is complex, how can we actually break it down right. into ways we can understand it?
Right. Exactly. So we break them down into these six endowments. And I should say, before I get into each endowment, I should mm-hmm. say a little bit about the word endowment.
Yep.
Because, you know, we're using this sort of interesting, just sort of distinctive language for right. what we're doing. And there's a reason for this.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of an endowment, so think about a financial endowment. Right.
right.
This is something that has to be invested in. It, you know, hopefully accrues value over time,
mm-hmm.
and then it has to be stewarded well.
Right.
Right. Similarly, with each of these endowments, as you'll see, these are realms of human activity that have, there's institutions, there's resources, there's people, there's practices and places that make each of these up.
Right.
That have to be invested in. They mm-hmm. have to be stewarded well. And we hope over time accrue value that then everyone can, right, benefit from.
Right. Right.
And together, and that's why the word endowment is important to us, because it gives you that sense both of value over time.
Right.
And that they have to be stewarded.
Right.
Now, what are these six endowments? Right. So we're using the language that sort of comes from us from the kind of ancients, the classics. Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So we talk about it in terms of the true, the good, the beautiful, the just, the prosperous, and the sustainable.
Right.
Right. Those are the kind of fundamental building blocks of thriving.
Mm-hmm.
Those activities that are, so let's take the true. What do we mean by that? The true is that realm of human activity. Again, think of all the, think in your community of all the institutions and the resources and the practices and places that are given over to education
right.
and learning and knowledge production.
So here, that's public schools, that's universities, that's research institutions.
Libraries.
Right.
You got
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm. Even book groups, right? In more informal
yeah.
settings.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
My wife's in one of those.
Yep.
So she's inside of that. Yeah.
She's inside that, right?
yep. The good.
The good. The good is, think of all those institutions and resources and practices and places given over towards moral and ethical formation of people.
Mm.
So here you can think of families.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of schools again. You can think of the Girls and Boys Club, the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. You can think about religious organizations, uh-huh. right, of all kinds, right? All given over to this activity that we value.
Right. The beautiful.
Yeah, you can think of the beautiful in sort of two ways. The first is this gets to your bit about the importance of design in some mm-hmm. ways. It's about what planners and architects called the built environment. It's the design of the buildings and the parks and the spaces between buildings and right. parks and so on and so forth, right? So it's how have we designed these things, and their kind of the aesthetic nature of these things, yeah. right? That we know when we go into a blighted neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
right? And we know when we go into a neighborhood, you know, that's a beautiful place, right? We know this. This is something that matters to most people in their daily lives. And then there's another way to think about it, which is simply the arts and cultural kinds of dimensions of our communities.
Right.
You know, basically all the institutions and organizations given to various forms of creative expression.
Fourth one, the sustainable.
Yeah. So this really has sort of two dimensions as well. This has to do first with what you think when you think of the sustainable, which is the natural environment,
mm-hmm.
right? How well are we stewarding the natural environment? So it can be connected to issues of energy. Or say, you know, Richmond has a riverfront, like how are we relating to the river,
mm-hmm.
right? So the natural environment. And then there's that of the physical body, right?
Right.
So say issues of health and wellness and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Number five.
Yeah.
The just and well ordered.
The just and well ordered. So this really has to do with our civic and political life.
Mm-hmm.
Again, all of the associations and community groups all the way to like law enforcement
right.
and the mayor's office and so forth.
That's your civic association, that's yep. police, that's city council.
Exactly.
And then the last one, the prosperous.
Right. So this is probably the one that most people think about most of the time when they mm-hmm. think about something like thriving in cities.
Right. Right.
They think about jobs, they think about business, they think about economic growth, they think about, you know, or the lack thereof. So they think about social service programs
right.
and poverty and inequality and right?
Yep.
These sorts of things.
And I think that one's the easiest to gravitate towards when you're saying, is this a healthy city?
Right.
I'm using air quotes. Because I think a lot of times when we're talking about a project, we say, hey, what's the return on investment?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Which I think is one way, and certainly an important way, but it's not the only way if what we're saying is a city is a complex place, and we need to look at all these different endowments when we're trying to make decisions in a discerning way going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that part of the challenge of our moment is, and many people realize this and are working hard to remedy it, is that we have only really privileged a single value in that ecology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is economic growth, which is let's make no bones about it. It's really important.
Right.
But what this ecology or web perspective helps us see is that there are other forms of value
right.
that are as important. And in fact, to fully unlock the value of the prosperous, as well as any other endowment. We need health in the other endowments.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about mid-sized cities.
Mm-hmm.
So thriving cities, you're working with these pilot cities,
yep.
Portland, Richmond, Orlando, Columbus, mm-hmm. Milwaukee. And I've been thinking about this because there's an article in The Atlantic and James Fallows, it's called How America is Putting Itself Back Together. And it looks at these mid-sized cities. And he said, many people are discouraged by what they hear and read about America, but the closer they are to the action at home, the better they like what they see. And so the question is, to what extent are mid-sized cities better positioned for the type of thriving you're talking about?
That's a good question. You know, I think that we need to understand, and I think in order to give some context to Fallow's comment, that we're living through a moment where cities are kind of resurging.
Hmm.
In their centrality, in the hopefulness that people put on them, right? So, you know, think back to like the 70s and 80s when
right.
people were fleeing our cities,
right?
Right? When they were war zones.
Mm-hmm.
And then think about in the 90s with technology, where everyone thought, oh, we were just going to telecommute. No one was going to live in cities
right.
anymore,
right.
right? Well, in fact, what's happened is just the opposite. What we see right now are trends where the old, what the planners call donut cities, where they had
yep.
an inner city that just deteriorated, right? And
right.
and then people moved out to the suburbs. So all the vibrancy and dynamism was in the suburbs with this kind of gaping hole. Now it's a reverse donut. People are flocking back to downtowns. Downtowns are going through revitalization. And that's actually pushing the problems from the inner city outward,
yep.
right? So we have a reverse donut. So One needs to understand that we're living through this moment where cities are regaining all of this interest and excitement and hopefulness, even as I will want to underscore that there mm-hmm. are serious problems that we have to confront. And so the question is really what you're getting at here is, okay, so we see this with respect to cities, but what kind of cities?
Right.
What kind of scale seems the most manageable for actually affecting changes that can actually make a difference.
Right.
You know, is a city the size of Hong Kong or New York, right? Or Mumbai or something. I mean, these are gigantic. Mm-hmm. We're living in a moment where also we have to understand that cities are going through a transformation, where we not only live in a time where humans are mostly an urban species, but that we now live in a time of mega cities.
Right.
Right.
The level, the scale, and the complexity, scale, and the density.
And the speed of migration to cities.
Right.
All right. Are creating kinds of problems that are just really hard to fathom.
Right.
So there is a growing, and then we sort of come back to our own country and we think about the political gridlock at the national level. Mm-hmm. So for all a host of reasons, in other words, people are turning to to the city as a place that's manageable. Right. So it seems to me that you can think about a mid-sized city as a place where there's more possibility for the kinds of civic and other kinds of action where people can get together around a problem from multiple sectors and walks of life in ways that the bigger cities make it harder. Now we chose mid-sized cities in part for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wouldn't want to imply is that the bigger cities are impossible, or that our approach is only works in a mid-sized city. In fact, the human ecology approach works at any scale.
Right.
We chose mid-sized cities mainly for methodological reasons.
Right. It's a little bit of a loaded question because my sense was the answer is no, this works for any city. Yeah. But if you're trying to study it and actually develop a framework, it's easier to go to Columbus, Ohio than to Hong Kong.
Right.
I also want to ask a question about upwardly mobile millennials.
Mm-hmm.
People talk a lot about that here. This is the Richard Florida argument where you hear a lot about if you attract young people to hip neighborhoods, they'll provide these amenities with coffee shops and bars and bookstores and music venues. And Edward Glaser, he's an economist at Harvard, he wrote in The Triumph of the City that there's a really strong track record of places that attract talent becoming places of long-term success, and that the most successful economic development policy is to attract, retain smart people, get out of the way, you know, because they come, there'll be energy, they'll actually create jobs, et cetera. This is another loaded question. Are upwardly mobile millennials good for the health of the city? Like if we just say, hey, we just need to attract these young professionals, we need to get them in, because that's going to set our city up for success. Is that the right way to think about it?
Well, it depends on good for whom.
Hmm.
So there's no question that we see certain patterns of upward, what you're calling upwardly mobile millennials into cities and revitalizing neighborhoods and so forth. But that's, you know, really only one part of a much larger story. And first of all, we're in the midst of a demographic shift. And then the question is, like, what happens once they start having kids, by the way?
Right.
Like, will they, like everyone else before them, go back out to the suburbs?
I'm thinking about that, like, my wife and I are having those conversations.
Right.
I think there are a lot of people like me that are trying to figure out, like, is this a grand experiment where we're living here now?
So. Yeah. So there's certain demographic issues that have to be sort of thought about what's happening here. So the Florida and the Glaser arguments are really premised on this notion of what they call human capital. And so cities have to become like, think of them like a beautiful tropical flower that's really trying to attract the bee, right?
Right.
And so cities, in a way, they live in an almost Darwinian kind of reality of competition with other cities.
Right.
And so this isn't just, you know, a good thing. It's a, in some ways, direly necessary thing to happen.
Sure.
So we see a big sorting taking place among cities and then within cities.
Yep.
Okay. And so there's no question that, that the upward millennial, the movement of millennials, as well as the retiring and well-off baby boomers are like, there's an influx of these demographics into cities that are playing a role in revitalizing down. That's who's buying these places in the inner city. But is that good for the people who were there before they came in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are getting pushed out? You know, this raises the thorny issue of what goes by the name of gentrification, a whole range of questions about inequality in our country.
Mm-hmm.
That is this really going to be the path that will solve inequality or simply deepen it?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a many-sided issue,
right?
With lots of question marks
Yeah.
around it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that it's complex. There's not an airtight. I wrestle with that. Like, if we only need to, attract millennials.
It's a perfect example of a silver bullet solution that never works.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It won't work because, at least from our way of thinking, it's only looking at one or two endowments.
Right.
And an unequally looking at them.
Yeah. Outsized. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Rather than taking this more holistic approach, that understands that you can't just, there is no silver bullet, like one group of people coming in is going to solve the rest of the problems.
Right.
It will be good for those people.
Right. Yep. I want to talk about unusual coalitions.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot. I don't know if you talk a lot about it or if I'm just most excited about it. Can you talk a bit about that concept and why it's important to a thriving city?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after, 5 or 6 years of research at trying to boil down what we think, and this is ongoing, but what we think is at the base of the most successful human ecologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
The healthiest human ecologies that we find, or the things that seem to be contributing most beneficially to an ecology of a place. Whenever we boil that down, it's not about money. It's not about policy. It's not about buildings and design. It's not about data. All those things matter.
Right.
But almost routinely, the thing that we boil down to is a set of relationships between people who are committed to the good of their city, and often people who you wouldn't expect to be bedfellows in any way.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who often either come from such divergent walks of life and backgrounds, or they would disagree fundamentally on pressing issues of the day, but they care about their place and they care about the people who live in those places. And somehow they've managed to, build trust. And that seems to be the thing that makes all the difference at the end of the day.
Yeah. I want to play a clip.
Okay.
So this is from, the YMCA has a prayer breakfast. Corey Widmer, who's a pastor at Third Church, gave the keynote address and he talked about unusual coalitions. He just does such a great job, I think, of conceptualizing what it is, why it's important, and how it comes to life. So I want to play the clip real quick and talk through it.
I remember as I prepared to move to Richmond about 10 years ago, I actually picked up The Economist magazine and was astonished to find in that magazine an article about Richmond, which said that this city has one of the highest rates of economic and jurisdictional segregation in the United States. Our region is one of profound ironies, that we played a key role in defending American freedoms and also a key role in defending slavery and institutionalized racism. And that even after slavery was abolished because of Jim Crow segregation and poll taxes and literacy tests and massive resistance, by 1970, there were deep patterns of residential and economic segregation and inequality that profoundly mark our region. And because Virginia is a Dillon state rule, Richmond is one of the only capital cities in the United States in which the city center is not a part of any of the adjoining jurisdictions, which has ensured that city residents and suburban residents remain profoundly divided and share little common vision for anything. And so here we are, Richmond friends, a network of fiefdoms. Whites with whites, blacks with blacks, Latinos with Latinos, immigrants with immigrants, rich with rich, poor with poor, suburbanites with suburbanites, urbanites with urbanites, educators only talk to educators, artists only with artists, business leaders only with business leaders, and our region is impoverished by our tribalism. Impoverished. True flourishing can only really happen when leaders and visionaries from many different sectors and many different perspectives and geographies come together. Even though they are seemingly unrelated and unconcerned for each other, come together for a vision of the common good. This is immensely difficult. I will tell you from experience, our pride, our tribalism, my selfishness, our unwillingness to trust one another, our prejudices and suspicions, these things are so strong. They're constantly threatening to undermine our commitments to unity. My friends, I'm just really here because I am just urging you. Our city needs a fresh movement of unusual coalitions, people and groups coming together across jurisdictions, across political parties, across vocational sectors, across socioeconomic and cultural barriers, and working together for the flourishing of our communities, especially for the sake of the most vulnerable populations. This is ultimately what makes a city great, not just the amenities and restaurants and rivers and stadiums and businesses and schools, but at root, what makes a city great is the strength and quality of unusual, unpredictable, subversive coalitions of trusting relationships that serve the common good.
The thing that I love about that is that he hits on the things that most people talk about in Richmond, which is racial fiefdoms, there's geographic fiefdoms with the city and the county, but there's also, I think, social, institutional, even vocational, like we talked about the hipsters and the lawyers. Why is this so hard? Why are there such barriers to actually creating these unusual coalitions?
Probably part of it is has to do with the way we have set up our institutions, right? So if we're educators, we've been trained as educators. We live in a kind of educational bubble in a way about what the incentives are for success in those fields, how we think about the nature of what it is we do as educators, right?
Yeah.
So a lot has to do with how we've actually established and created these institutional settings in which we live in our vocations and our professions and so mm-hmm. forth. So at least on the front of vocations, I think that the incentive structures have all been to keep people in their silos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
A lot of the other stuff is, human nature.
Yep.
We like to group with people that are like us.
Yep.
Whether that's class or race or ethnicity or religion. And so all of the default modes we have are to do that. It takes a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of risk. It takes a lot of intentionality.
Right. And that requires energy and effort.
Right.
And like I would rather
exactly,
take my groceries inside than say hi to my neighbor because I want to eat dinner and watch Netflix.
Right. You just worked a long day.
Right.
You're exhausted.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You got it.
What have you guys seen in your research so far? Is there a context for how to actually create these unusual coalitions? Like there's probably not a magic formula, right? But have you seen something where you say, when this happens, when we see these kind of elements at play, there's a greater chance that these unusual coalitions can come to be?
That's a great question. I guess my quick answer to it would be that it depends on what we mean and at what scale. So I think that unusual coalitions have been happening in cities all the time, usually under the radar and usually at very small scales. Mm. But I think it's important to say that we're also living at a time where people are waking up to this. All right. There is actually a pretty significant paradigm shift underway in how people think about our communities and our problems.
Mm.
So there's a whole movement that goes by the name of collective impact, for example, in which this generally is like, okay, we've got an education gap problem in our community. So rather than just educators trying to solve it, or just one group, they want to partner with all the kind of appropriate
right.
groups,
yep.
right? So this has become a kind of a popular way now, increasingly popular way, that communities are, whether it's philanthropy or government agencies mm-hmm. or even the private sector, mm-hmm. are understanding that we all need to work together. We need to coordinate. We can't have all this redundancy, right? Everybody trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So we need to coordinate and we need to collaborate. Now, just how much that is actually rhetoric versus actual practice is another question. And in some places it's practiced better than others. But there is this move to care about things together, and I think it's gaining traction. And there are various kinds of organizational efforts underway to cultivate these things. I think that there is a burgeoning consciousness that this is important, and that people are wanting to figure out how to do it. Is there, again, a magic formula for it? I don't think so. But what I am convinced about, and this is, I guess, the most important thing I want to say on this question, is that the kinds of unusual coalitions that make a difference are the ones that have people who are willing to make sacrifices of their own well-being and welfare to stick something out, even when it's really difficult. If you think this is an easy thing to build a relationship with someone who is different from you or disagrees with you fundamentally, right? If you think that's easy, you know, you got another thing coming.
Yeah.
So it's the people who've been committed over the long haul in their relationships and have been willing to do the hard work. Those are the ones that really matter.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to that. It's easy to get excited about unusual coalitions. It sounds amazing. Right. Let's do, why can't we do that thing and do it in Richmond?
Right.
But what you're saying is, essentially, count the cost. This isn't easy. If you actually want to do it in a way that's meaningful and you want to cross the street, cross the aisle.
Because it's going to have to change you.
Right.
Right. If you're just doing it in a way that doesn't change you, that at least doesn't create the vulnerability and the and the risk of having to change a little bit in the process to learn from it, then it'll never be successful.
It can't be cosmetic.
Right. It cannot be cosmetic.
Deeper.
It's not a way of self-actualizing in some kind of simple way.
An institution is not going to listen to this podcast. It's probably somebody doing dishes with your earbuds in or riding around in their car. What advice do you have to like a single person to actually partner with others in like practical, real ways?
Sure. I mean, I think that the thing, again, that we find over and over again in our research is that our communities, our society is premised for its success on engaged citizens, on people who are committed to the good of their neighbors at whatever scale, in whatever way. And while our approach is trying to help people, give them a framework for thinking about their community in a more holistic way, at the end of the day, this is meant to empower individual people and the and various organizations and communities to be citizens, to not just care about their family or their friends, their intimates, but to care about their neighbors.
Right. You were describing a nature of engagement that requires that we actually see clearly what's happening in the world around us, that we're able to see the complexity, and that we're also able to discern how we can act and who we can act with in a way that actually brings about good for those around us, that isn't just about me and like my house and my family, but for the good of the whole. So Josh, thank you for the work you're doing to help us to see cities clearly. What do you guys got coming up?
We hope to be here in Richmond doing some work in a couple of neighborhoods in the South Side with a guy named Bob Argabright. And we hope here in the Churchill area. We're working with some folks here, and our hope is to, over the beginning sometime in the summer, to do some what we call create a neighborhood narrative atlas.
Whoa, what is that?
Yeah, that takes our framework, our endowment framework, our ecology framework, and it tells the story of the neighborhood in terms of those six endowments in a way that brings together quantitative kinds of assessment, right? Data about the place in various ways. It embeds that data in the local history and geography of the place. We then visualize it with various kinds of mapping, so you can actually see the distributions of these numbers and stuff in sort of three dimensions. And then finally, and again, most importantly, we then tell the story of actual people. So we take all this information we've gathered, and then we take actual people from the neighborhood that we tell their story in terms of this information. And we think that this would be, this is the kind of, This is the kind of analysis that we need if we're going to understand how to take the ecological model mm-hmm. and make it practical.
Neighborhood Narrative Atlas.
Yeah.
The thing I love about that model is that when you're trying to understand and diagnose what's happening in Richmond, it's usually very numeric, statistical, almost like rational.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like X percent of children are under poverty in the city of Richmond. Okay. That is true, and that is a fact, and that is accurate. But most of the time I go home and I watch season whatever on Netflix because I don't really understand what that means in like right. time and place. But if you show me a video or I
of
hear
an actual person.
Yeah, or I hear a story of a person that is dealing with this, that's when I say like, whoa, like we got to do something about this. Like, yeah, I knew that number.
Right.
But you actually showed me how it comes to life, and now I'm interested. Now I'm leaning in.
Yeah. Well, you think about it, there's two different kinds of, at least maybe more, kinds of people that we need to three basic groups, right, that we need to think about here. The first are the decision makers. And it turns out that most of the time the decision makers are going to be trafficking in numbers, right? They want to see the data.
Right.
Right? And so you got to provide that.
On some level, as they should.
Right.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the stories can actually obscure actual patterns and trends right. that the mm-hmm. numbers can show, mm-hmm. right? Not that numbers can't be abused, of course. But then we have the people who volunteer and the people who work at the level of practitioners who are trying to make a difference.
Those are people on the ground.
Those are people on the ground, right? Trying to get things done.
That's when you were in the reverse ice cream truck.
Exactly, exactly. Right? They need the numbers, but they also need more than the numbers. They need to understand context,
mm-hmm.
right? In fact, all three groups need all of these things, but I'm emphasizing in some ways the things they most need. And so they need context. They need to know how to take these numbers and put them into context as they deal with the problems they're confronting
yep.
in the lives of the people that they're, right, they're working with. But then finally, there are the people, they're the citizens, the residents themselves, the people who are often just a statistic, right?
Yeah.
And both for those people to have a voice in this thing. So we're not just working, they're not just objects of our interventions. We're actually working along with them, empowering them.
Yeah.
We need to understand who they are in their full moral complexity.
Uh-huh.
Right? And stories are the things that bring that to life.
Right.
So we need all of these dimensions for different purposes. But we need to hold on to all of the dimensions together.
Yeah. How do you not lose one at the expense of the other?
Yeah.
I'm curious, as an outsider, what is your perception of Richmond?
My perception of Richmond is that, honestly, it's exciting. My perception is that Richmond is on the cusp of a renaissance of a kind. I think it has incredible potential, given its history, given its the struggles that it's been through. I think Richmond has the possibility of leading the way on a number of issues precisely because it's had the history that it's had.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful.
I am as well. Josh Yates, thanks for your time. I appreciate your thinking and your heart, both you and the work at the Institute and Thriving Cities. We wish you the best.
Hey, thanks so much. Pleasure being here.
Thanks.
Cool.
For more information about the project, you can check out thrivingcities.com. We've also posted a great video that visualizes their model on the blog section of our website at twopeoplepodcast.com. As always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your favorite podcasts on the internet. Our theme is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne is a friend that would drive you to the airport, no questions asked. And that's it. Thanks for listening.